You're listening to Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association and sponsored by attorney Patrick Dolan from Conti and Dolan and attorney Molly Wells from Wallace Miller. Now, here's John Hansen and Let's Get Legal.
At 2:09 on a Saturday afternoon. Thanks for joining us, everybody. I don't know if it's foggy where you are, but it's still foggy here downtown. We are 18 floors up and I can't see across the Chicago River right now. I hope you're enjoying your Saturday. Hopefully we get some sun the next couple of days. Boy, that would be nice as we continue to thaw out. Molly Condon Wells joins us now, partner at Wallace Miller. Molly, welcome to Let's Get Legal.
Thanks for having me here. I'm really excited. I've been practicing my radio voice.
You're doing great.
Thanks.
It's very sultry. There you go. Molly Condon Wells. You're from Wallace Miller. We've met your partner before here on the air. Tell us just a little bit briefly about what Wallace Miller is all about.
So we are a plaintiff's firm, and really I would say our main focus is representing people who need our help. We represent everyday people who have had something really bad happen to them. And there's different ways that we can bring cases. We can do it through a mass tort, we can do it through a class action, or just an individual case. But
right.
The focus of our work really is to help people.
And a lot of times for those broader cases that impact a lot of people, as we'll get into a little bit later, it starts with one phone call sometimes. And someone that something happened to you, it doesn't seem quite right. I was injured, I was maybe abused, something along those lines. But they're afraid to call. But that one person who calls your office first and foremost can really start a chain reaction, can't they?
Absolutely.
Yeah. You're from the Beverly neighborhood, right?
I am. Southside Irish.
I like that. What do you love about Chicago? I mean, you've stayed mainly in our area your whole life, just like me.
Yeah. It's an incredible city, really. I think what sets Chicago apart from every other American city is the people. I mean, we've got a great lakefront. And
right.
I just think everybody here is so nice. And you hear that over and over again, is that people are really friendly and really willing to help. So
why law?
Why law? Well, I grew up in a legal family. And it's funny, I think people that grow up in legal families are either like, heck yes or heck no. And I was heck yes.
Thanks for censoring yourself too, by the way. Good job there.
And I also grew up in the Legally Blonde era. So, I mean, to say that Elle Woods didn't have an impact on me, I think would be a lie.
Really? Okay, so it was in the family and you decided to get into it. I asked this of all first-time lawyers, like, how do you narrow down what field you want to do? Because law is so broad. There's so many things you can do. Talk us through that journey a little bit.
I always knew that I wanted to do trial work. And so I think that actually usually lends itself to having work either in the criminal space or the civil space where you have, you know, real clients that have issues that need to be litigated. So I was always very much on the train of I want to help people and I want to be in a courtroom doing it because I think that's just kind of where my natural skills are.
You want to be in the trial.
Yes.
You want to be in what we see on TV, even though it's not quite what we see on TV, but you want that.
Absolutely. Yes.
You're a fighter, it seems like.
I guess you could say that.
I mean, you kind of have to be working for a firm like yours, right? I mean, you are fighting for the little guy, the little woman, I don't know how to say it. You're fighting for the little person against sometimes some really big, important people, right?
That have a lot of resources that are willing to use those resources. So I guess you're right. It is oftentimes a really long fight, but it's definitely one that's worth fighting.
Why did you partner up at Wallace Miller? Talk us through that journey.
I started at a firm working with my partner, Ed, who I think was on this show last month. And when he came to me and said that he wanted to start his own firm, it was really a no-brainer for me to go work with him because we really had the same vision for helping clients and had the same values with respect to the type of work that we do.
That's great. Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to dive into deeper about the cases that you're working on, some big cases that you've got, and just learn a little bit more about what you do. Chatting with Molly Condon Wells, a partner over at Wallace Miller. And Molly, one of the areas you work a lot in is in cases of sexual abuse. And this is a very difficult discussion to have. I know many listeners, you know, we've been talking about sexual abuse, especially over the last few years, about cases that have come forward as the stigma around victims feeling guilt associated with that. It's still there, but we've, I think, gotten better as a society at least talking about it. Why are those the cases that, I don't want to say you like to work on, but why are those cases that are important to you?
They're important for a number of reasons. Number one, I think the work that comes out of it can actually have a huge impact, not on the individual person who was harmed, but in broader society. Because in my opinion, the civil justice system is one of the ways that we can impact future policies and procedures. So when companies and institutions realize we can't allow this to happen in places where we should be protecting people, then they change what they're doing. And so I see it not only as a way to help individual people who've had incredibly horrible things happen to them, but it also is an impetus for change in society.
I guess we should lay some like definitional foundation down here. What, I mean, it's a broad range of things, but sexual abuse, generally speaking, it's different than harassment, say, like what we would talk about at a workplace, right?
It is. And, you know, this is a really tough subject to talk about because there's different forms of abuse. I think everybody that's listening can kind of imagine what that is. They've heard about the really famous cases in the news with Bill Cosby, Larry Nassar, those types of things. What people in positions of power do to people who are vulnerable, that's just completely unacceptable and something that they never wanted to happen to them.
I know a lot of times, well, I guess I shouldn't wax poetic about it. You're the expert here. Is it often when someone comes forward with sexual abuse allegations against someone that there often are more after that?
I think that there is. You know, we've seen it over and over again in a lot of these big cases against the Catholic Church, against Boy Scouts of America. Usually when there is somebody who is an abuser, they put themselves in positions where that they can easily access multiple victims. And so that happens a lot. But then there are also just a lot of individual cases as well. It's not one or the other. It happens in both scenarios.
Are laws better now than they used to be in terms of dealing with this? Or does it depend on which state you live in?
It does depend on what state you live in. It really does. Every state has the ability to, through their legislator, create whatever law they want to, both with respect to allowing what types of damages are available, but also to allow the statute to be extended based off of when somebody was harmed or abused. So actually, New York, just within the last 2 years, allowed for a look-back statute so that victims of childhood sexual abuse were able to bring forward claims. And there's been a number of other states that have done the same thing. But I will say that Illinois has some of the best statutes in the entire country to protect victims of abuse.
I want to talk about that statute of limitation things because oftentimes when someone is abused, they're a child, right? And I think our body has a way of trying to repress that sort of memory or a way to just deal with it. And oftentimes people, I imagine, once they realized exactly what had happened to them at a different age, were beyond the statute of limitations and that justice was left unserved. Do you think that's the case a lot of times?
It is the case, unfortunately, a lot of times. And it makes sense why people are hesitant to come forward, because it's, for most people, one of the most traumatic and shameful and sad things that they have really ever been through. So, you know, for a lot of people, they're just afraid and they don't want to talk about it. They don't want to relive it. So they don't come forward. Or for some people, they don't even realize it because they've repressed it because it was so traumatic. And I think, you know, the statute of limitations in a lot of ways can be an impediment to that, but not always. It really depends on the individual case, when the abuse happened, how old the person was. And so that's why I say that Illinois has some of the best laws in the country, because there are ways to extend the statute of limitations is the best way to put it.
Of course, there are circumstances where it's strangers involved and something happens to a child or to another adult, I should say. I keep on mentioning child, but obviously sexual abuse can happen at any age, correct?
Yes. And, you know, I have represented people who are adults when it happens.
Right. I just want to make that clear, obviously. Yeah. A lot of times it's strangers, but we just hear so often that it's often people, whether it's extended members of family, immediate members and family, or people in trusted positions. Is that what makes this even more difficult to dive into?
I think so. And, you know, the civil justice system is different than the criminal justice system,
right? Can you explain that a little bit for us?
Yeah. And I should say with the caveat that obviously criminal law is not my area of specialty, but from a very basic sense, you know, there is a criminal way to prosecute criminals for doing criminal things. That's separate and apart from, you know, what I do, which is pursue the civil damages in a case, which typically are monetary damages. So by me pursuing a case, the person who was the abuser isn't unfortunately going to go to jail. And there actually have been a number of cases I've worked on where the abuser didn't go to jail, never got caught, either because the statute of limitations had run out and the person was, you know, a child when they were abused, or there just wasn't enough evidence for the state's attorney to decide, yeah, I'm going to prosecute this claim. The burden of proof is different.
And that's what I wanted to dive into. So if someone is sexually abused, they have the right to call, obviously, the police. That is an encouraged thing to do, perhaps. Police come. There's an investigation. If that person is, there's enough evidence to be charged, then there's a trial. They have to be found guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. And then they might go to prison for their abuse. The civil world is different. Can you explain a little bit how that works?
So in a civil case, it's not absolutely necessary that a person be criminally convicted or prosecuted to be successful in a civil case, because again, the burden of proof is just different. It's only more likely than not. So it allows people, I think, a way to have some closure on what happened in the event that a criminal case was not able to be pursued.
If a criminal case is being pursued, can a civil case also be pursued simultaneously?
It can, but what typically happens is that the civil case is put on pause until the criminal case resolves because, you know, the Fifth Amendment. People don't want to testify or give a deposition in a civil case when they've got an ongoing criminal case as well. So
what happens when someone calls you and they, you know, maybe they're pursuing civil or they don't know what they're supposed to do? What's that conversation like? Because I imagine in your bones, you want the person that did something wrong to go to jail. You also want to represent someone in a civil case. So what's that delicate balance like when you talk to someone who's been abused?
Well, the first thing that I do when I talk to somebody who's had something horrible happen to them is really just listen to their story. Because I think for a lot of people, just the ability to know that there's someone that they can talk to who believes them and that they feel they can trust to divulge this really horrible and personal thing that happened to them. That's really my first thing is to understand what happened. And that's got to be the first step in every conversation. And then number two is really figuring out, okay, what is the plan of action here and how can we go forward with the case? And it really varies case to case. If there's an ongoing criminal case, that's different than if, you know, this happened 10 or 15 years ago.
Right. And I guess you can walk someone through that. I don't know what the rules are about, like advising someone to go to the police or not, but I imagine you guys can at least be a sounding board. And like you said, believe what someone is saying, what a victim is telling you, and at least give them that comfort. But can you offer that kind of, maybe here's another step you could pursue sort of angle?
Yeah, I think every lawyer does what they can, or at least I hope. I know that I do. Does what they can within their abilities to help their clients, even if it's not directly in their wheelhouse.
We talked about how one accusation against someone can turn into many. I imagine you've worked on cases like that.
Yeah. And, you know, the crazy thing is in these types of cases, a lot of it is he said versus she said. That's in the, you know, from what I understand, a lot of the times the issue in the criminal case as well, right? So it makes it incredibly tough. But when you have a situation where there is a person who has been reported multiple times by multiple victims over many years, it becomes a lot easier to make the argument that this wasn't a one-off instance and it's not just what he or she said, because I do have clients who are both men and women versus what, you know, the abuser said. So, and that happens a lot where you have clients who say, this happened in this place and this is how this person did it. And then you talk to another person who has a same or similar story. And then there's another person who has a same or similar story. And so you realize that there is a pattern to how this person does it. And usually somebody else knows about it.
Strength in numbers, essentially.
Exactly. Yep.
It's got to be a delicate balance, though, because as a law firm, you hear someone and you think that there might be other victims potentially out there. You're not going to just come on the radio and say, please call us right now. Or maybe do you? I don't know. Like, how do you build up a case against someone? How do you maybe find or at least open the door to welcome other potential victims in to call you or to reach out? That must be difficult.
It is difficult, but, you know, clients come to us. So we are fortunate where people just call us and then we're able to put the pieces together.
And how does it work? I mean, you have that initial conversation. Okay, you take on someone's case. Maybe there's multiple people. What sort of investigative tools do you have? You're not the police, right? How do you go about that?
Again, it really varies case to case. So when it's, you know, a case that's really in the public record, that makes it easier because you can find out information about the abuser by just looking at what's available in the public files.
You mean like for if there was a criminal charge
Correct.
At some point? Okay.
Yeah. And if there's not, then sometimes, you know, our clients will have evidence that they give to us kind of in the initial investigation that we're able to use. But then, as in any case, really what you have to do is file a lawsuit and you seek discovery and you get the information from the defendants.
And that's where I was going to go. The idea being that you guys in a civil case have the power of deposition, right? You can depose people or you can file a lawsuit and seek discovery to do what? Interviews? Like, how does that work? I mean, I'm just trying to think of someone who went through something terrible. They feel like they're on an island. And what ways you can help them feel like you're not alone and we're building this case for you?
The classic way to build any civil case is to get documents and to take depositions. So we do that really in any case that we work on is to try to collect evidence by uncovering what we think is going to support, you know, our theory of liability. So, you know, typically what we do is we send out what are called interrogatories asking for documents that we think are relevant or going to help the case. And when we are pursuing civil cases, usually there is some sort of institution that's involved. It's not necessarily just an individual. This is, you know, a university or a hospital or a camp or a school, places that have records and would keep records of things like this happening.
What about anonymity? Do people get that in civil cases?
Yes. So again, a really great statute that exists in Illinois is you are allowed to pursue these types of claims under a pseudonym. So if your case is filed, it would be filed under John Doe or Jane Doe. And so your name would be completely anonymous in terms of the public record.
And that's not like that in every state?
I don't want to say yes or no.
Okay, that's
because
fair.
There are, you know, different laws in every state, but it's a great thing about Illinois.
Okay, great. That's fine to say. You know, you're practicing here in Illinois. I don't expect you to know the laws of all 50 states, but you probably know a lot more than I do. All right, Molly Condon-Wells, partner over at Wallace Miller. I've got a minute before the news. We're going to chat a little bit afterwards, but what is it? Is it someone just going to the website, giving you guys a call? If someone is listening right now and they experience something and they just want to just talk through it, is that the best step for someone to do it?
Yeah, I think so. We'd be happy to hear someone's story and find out what happened if there's some way we can help them.
WallaceMiller.com is the website I see here. There is a phone number for a free phone consultation. I'll give this. I'll ask during the break, too, if there's an even better number people can reach. But I do see on the website 312-467-7362. Is that what number? I'm getting some nods across the glass. Yes. 312-467-7362 if this is something that might have impacted you and you want some closure or you just want to ask someone, a non-judgmental person, just to listen and hear what your story is. And, okay, that the best way to do it?
Yes.
All right, very good. Okay. These are delicate conversations to have, of course, and we'll continue it. And we also are going to learn a little bit about the WBAI and something that Molly is very active in. My guest, new to the show, but you got a half hour in now, Molly. You're a veteran at this point. There you go. Welcome.
Thanks.
It's Molly Condon-Wells, who's a partner at Wallace Miller, who handles all sorts of things, individual cases, big group cases, mass tort, right? That's what we called it?
Mass
That's
tort.
That's what Ed was telling me about
yes.
last time, which is fascinating. Big cases all over the country that really help people out, individuals, and as you said, can impact laws, can change laws. I mean, that must be make you feel good when you know that if you can win big cases or bring these big cases, that legislatures pay attention.
Absolutely. And it's not just the laws, too, just internal company policies and procedures and how they handle things, because they know that if they don't change it, that there's potentially huge liability for them. And unfortunately, we live in a country where money talks. So if people know at the end of the line, they're going to have a large check they're going to have to write, then that has some influence.
It sure does. 312-981-7200 if you have any questions you want to text in. The 847 wanted to know, we were talking about sexual abuse cases. Sometimes they're big and broad, many allegations against one individual. Sometimes it's just one-on-one. They want to know, how long do these cases usually take to pan out? Boy, that's an open-ended question, but what's your guidance on that?
So the more complex a case is, I would just say as a general rule, the more parties that are involved, the longer the case is, just because of the nature of the complexities involved. So some of our mass tort class action cases can take 7, 8, 9, 10 years. But, you know, we work as aggressively as we can to move cases forward so that they're resolved as quickly as possible. You know, in an ideal world, a case would be resolved within a year or two, but it really just depends on the courts and, you know, people's scheduling, and there's a lot of outside factors that impact it. So it really just depends.
815 brought up a good point. They said that a lot of people that are victims of sexual abuse may have limited means. Are they coming to the table with money to hire a firm like yours?
No. So we work on a contingency fee basis. So if we do not, you know, get a recovery, then we eat whatever costs that we spent litigating the case, and the client owes nothing.
The 312 had a follow-up to how long cases can take. Would a potential victim be in your office every day, in court every day? You mentioned multiple years. Are they inundated with it, or are they able to live their own lives while the case is going on?
They are able to live their own lives while the case is going on. That's, in my opinion, why you hire a lawyer, so that they kind of take that burden off of you and they worry about the case on a day-to-day. Obviously, we give people updates, and there are parts where there has to be some involvement, either through answering discovery or sitting for a deposition. And if the case has to go to trial, then that's a pretty big commitment. But otherwise, you know, we really deal with the day-to-day, and they're able to go on.
Just to kind of put a button up on this conversation about people that have been victims of sexual abuse and going through civil litigation, we have many, many listeners that listen to all these programs, and it'd be a wonderful world to imagine that none of our listeners right now are a victim of sexual abuse. But I'm sure the reality is, and the numbers show, that that isn't the case. Someone listening right now, many of you, have been victims of sexual abuse. I know it's a very individual decision. What's that process like of deciding whether or not to even call you? I imagine you respect both sides of it. If some people don't, okay. But, like, you must have talked to people that have sat on that decision for years, right?
I say to all my clients that I think they are incredibly brave, and to come forward and even be willing to explore the option of pursuing a civil case is probably going to be a greater fulfillment for them than even if there is a recovery. Because when you go through something that's that traumatic and that horrible, there's probably really nothing ever that will make you whole again. And that's the whole point of the civil justice system, is to make victims whole again through monetary damages. But when you've had something that traumatic happen to you, I think it's incredibly difficult to say that anything will ever necessarily make you whole again. So just coming forward and being able to speak about it is hard, but it's necessary, and it's very brave.
I think you bring up such a great point there, Molly, that you're not promising ultimate closure. You're not promising that those memories will be erased, or that they won't think of them and feel sad or feel angry again. But you are working through the system that we have to do what you can for people to at least provide some comfort. And I know some people are like, is monetary comfort anything? Of course it doesn't do away with what happened, but it can provide some help for you in difficult times, right?
Yes.
Okay. WallaceMiller.com, by the way, is where you go. The phone number, 312-467-7362. I'm going to say it one more time because someone may not feel comfortable calling and asking for that number. It is 312-467-7362 for a non-judgmental conversation with whatever people want to share, right?
Yes. Please feel free to call.
Okay. I want to talk a little bit about the WBAI. You're very active about that. What's that all about?
WBAI is the Women's Bar Association of Illinois, and it's an incredible organization that really was founded, and I think I should know the year, but it's the late
it's okay.
It's the late 1800s, one of the oldest.
Oh, wow.
One of the oldest and largest bar organizations in the state, that was founded to promote and advance the welfare of women, both women lawyers and just generally women at large in the state of Illinois.
It was 1914. I just looked it up.
Well, it sounds better if
close.
it's 1800s, right?
I shouldn't even called you out on that. Boy, I'm rude. What a mean radio host I am. I just went to the website. Sorry, everyone. Founded still well over 100 years ago, 110 years ago. And is there still a discrepancy between the number of men lawyers and women lawyers, or have we made so much progress on this recently that it's not even a noticeable thing anymore, which is a great thing?
I just read an article that suggested there was some study that said now women, for the first time ever, women associates surpass men associates in law firms. And I think that's great, but there still is a huge disparity when it comes to women in positions of partnership, and even more so in equity partnership. So we've still got some way to go. When you think about the fact that women couldn't even vote in this country until the 1920s, which was 100 years ago,
right.
I mean, it's been a century, but we've still got some progress to make.
Well, when you think about it, was, what, 40 or 50 years ago, a woman couldn't apply for a mortgage without a man, couldn't open a checking account or a credit card without a man. Yeah, we've made some progress, certainly. There is a way to go, and I think that's always a great point that people bring up about in the management positions, right, in the leadership positions. A lot of that is just a matter of time, right? I think that as the system works its way through. But there are still barriers to entry in management for women and all sorts of other classes, too.
Yes, there is. But even in my career, I have seen major advancements. So I think we're catching up.
What else do you want us to know about Wallace Miller? We got about another minute left. What's your elevator pitch to people about what you do, what your firm does?
We are a firm that strongly believes that we are able to make a difference. And it doesn't matter, you know, how long it's going to take for us to fight on your behalf. We're committed to seeing cases through. And so if somebody feels that they have been wronged, we want to help you.
And it's, we talked about sexual abuse, but you've worked on hair relaxer cases. I know that your Ed was talking about cases with a mesh lining used for some women that were wrong and defective and shouldn't have been used. Huge cases. So it's against what? Products, companies, people. I mean, if you've been wronged is a broad statement, but really it needs to be that broad, right?
Yeah. I mean, there is no shortage of wrongdoing in this world. So we're here if you need it.
Right. Boy, that's not the cheeriest way to end it. That's true, though. That is true. All right, Molly, we appreciate you coming on. I hope you'll do it again soon, okay?
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Molly Condon Wells, partner at Wallace Miller. Again, the website, wallacemiller.com. The phone number, 312-467-7362.